Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, I'm Jim Mallard, host of The Mallard Report. On The Mallard Report, along with my guest, we will have a conversation where we will share thoughts and opinions. For more information, my bio, past shows, social media links, and so much more, visit mallard.com. MALLIARD.com. And thanks for listening. I want to welcome everybody to the program this evening. Before we begin, don't forget to go over to check out schooloferrors.com. David Perdin was on last week. He was a wonderful guest as we talked about school safety and safety in general. At schooloferrors.com, perfect back-to-school gift for your, I don't want to say teachers, but parents that are concerned with their children going to schools, and just everybody pretty much anymore as the world spins out of control. But that's not why we're here tonight. Why we're here tonight is Larry Olmsted, the author of Real Foods, Fake Foods. Did I say that right? I wrote the website down. I didn't get that. That moment of, I wrote the website down, not the book title. I'm hoping it's the same. Smashing hit, food critic. What am I missing, Larry? There's that. I was reading your bio on my email today, and I went, "That's more than I've done." Period. And that's just what you've managed to put in an email bio.
Well, you know, I try to keep busy, but I've written for a lot of newspapers and magazines for 20 plus years as a journalist. I've written several books, and as you mentioned, my last one, Real Food, Fake Food: Why You Don't Know What You're Eating and What You Can Do About It, was sort of the breakout hit, New York Times bestseller.
So, okay, let's go here. What is the, like, when I say fake food, I think, like, really processed, like, chicken nuggets or something like that. But that's not exactly what you're talking about, is it?
It's not, because my thing is, you know, I try not to be judgmental, because we all have different styles, you know? If you love chicken nuggets, you should be able to eat chicken nuggets. I'm not telling people to, like, you know, be a vegan or eat differently. The thing is, if you go and buy chicken nuggets and you're not getting chicken nuggets, say, you know, you buy chicken nuggets and you're getting sawdust nuggets, that to me is fake food. So whatever it is you want to buy, if you're being deceived and sold something different, that's when it's fake. The quality isn't good.
Right, and I hear sawdust. Now, I know it's in something we're probably going to get to here in a little bit, but are you talking legitimate, straight-up sawdust, like... I go out back and the byproduct of sawing my logs, or is this, I mean, I know it can't be real sawdust.
No, so that was maybe a bad example because you brought up chicken nuggets. Chicken nuggets isn't one of the foods in my book. I was just, you know, using it because you mentioned it. But I give you a more concrete example that happens all the time, say, would be if you went to a restaurant and ordered, say, a grouper sandwich, and you didn't get grouper. You get some farmed... Asian catfish you never heard of that's raised with drugs that maybe, you know, are illegal in the United States and should never have been imported, and you're paying for grouper, which is an expensive fish. So, you know, in these cases, you're getting you're the victim of an economic fraud because you're way overpaying for what your food, but in many cases, it's a health fraud, too, because what they're serving you might be dangerous.
So I watched your TED Talk yesterday afternoon. I was going to say this afternoon, then I realized there was a whole day in there, which scares me. And you gave the perfect analogy when you started about the car. Let's start there. That way everybody can be on the same page, since I've seen that. I don't want to jump the gun and mislead my listeners here.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, I like cars. But, you know, if I make the point, car shopping is not something many people enjoy, even if you're into cars, right? You go in, you always feel like you're going to kind of get ripped off, and it's a stressful experience, and nobody enjoys shopping for a car. But I make the analogy, you know, if you go in and had the perfect car shopping experience, You go in, they're friendly, they offer you a great deal right away, and it's a great price, it's everything you wanted, and you're like, I can't believe it, this is the perfect car shopping experience. But then the salesman says to you, wait, there's a plan B. I can sell you the car you wanted with all the options you want for, say, $25,000, or for twice as much money, $50,000, I can sell you just the engine, the steering wheel, and the driver's seat. Which do you want to do? Well, you'd be crazy to take great plan B. You pay twice as much and get less. But that's the way food is sold in this country. And all the time, every day at supermarkets across the country, we pay more for less. And, you know, instead of buying the whole food for a certain price, we pay more to get less of it.
Now, when you say Whole Foods, I'm imagining the chain of markets, but that's not what you're thinking either.
Yeah, no, in this case, I'm talking literally whole, like, let's say a chicken, right? You buy a whole chicken, and you know what it is. It's a chicken. It looks like a chicken. You know how to cook it. You put it in the oven. But a lot of people don't want to buy that whole chicken. They want to buy a boneless, skinless chicken breast. So they charge you twice as much or more per pound to buy that boneless, skinless chicken breast. And what you're doing is you're leaving all the rest of the meat and all the flavor off the table. And, you know, that's a very stark example. Sometimes you want maybe a pack of boneless chicken breast because you're only one person and you don't need a whole chicken. But every time you buy any kind of food that's been processed, and I don't necessarily mean processed like chemically processed, just cut up or taken away from its natural state, you're paying someone to do that. And, you know, Americans leave a lot, you know, we already have issues in this country with food waste and budgetary constraints. So you leave a lot on the table when you overpay for less.
So I've got a list of specific things that you've mentioned through the years. We'll get into that here in a few minutes. But where did you get this project started at? Where was the genesis idea for all of this?
Well, for years, you know, I write a lot on travel and food around the world, so I've had the, wonderful fringe benefit of having, you know, traveled around the world and eaten some great food in some great places. And I was in Italy and went to a dairy that makes Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese. It's known as the king of cheeses in the cheese industry, kind of considered the world's greatest cheese. And I was talking to the cheesemaker, and he was, you know, talking about the cheese market in Italy, and he said, oh, yeah, it's not like your country. And I said, what do you mean? He's like, well, you know, there they can sell you anything and call it Parmesan cheese, and you don't know what you're getting, and you don't know what went into it, and if it has chemicals, and the quality, and its age, and what it's made out of. Whereas, like, in Italy, when you buy Parmesan cheese, it means a very specific thing, like champagne in France. So I started thinking about that, and I kind of put it on the back shelf. And then about a year later, I went to Japan, and I tried the Kobe beef, which is their really famous product. You know, it's like the Rolls Royce of steak, the world's most famous and expensive and coveted steak. And it is really good, and it's very different from the steak we get. You know, I tried it, and I was like, oh, that's great. And then I came back to the U.S., and I saw Kobe beef on the menu at a fancy steakhouse. And I tried it again, and it was nothing like what I had in Japan. And I thought about that, and it didn't really make sense because a lot of steak is something that we get frozen a lot. It travels well. It's not one of those foods that shouldn't taste just as good here as it did in Japan. So I was like, I wonder why it's so different. So I looked into it, and I quickly discovered, about 15 years ago, that the importation of Japanese beef was banned at the time by the USDA because they had an outbreak of mad cow disease and had been banned for several years. So it was illegal to import any Japanese beef into the United States, yet these restaurants were charging people $300 a steak for Kobe beef. That clearly was not Kobe beef because you couldn't get steak from Japan. And I could tell right away when I tasted it. So then I wrote an article about that for Forbes, basically how you're getting ripped off if you by the Kobe beef, and the reader response was incredible. I mean, so much more vehement than pretty much any other story I had done, and this isn't even a food that affects a lot of people. You know, how many, you know, it's not like you know, starving moms are going to the supermarket to buy Kobe beef for their kids, right? It's like 1% of food. And so I thought, you know, if something that really doesn't affect people very much bothers people so much, what if this was more pervasive in our everyday life? And then I thought about the Parmesan cheese, and then I did some more research, and I discovered, unfortunately, that the Kobe beef was just sort of the tip of the iceberg of what retailers and restaurants are willing to scam you out when they sell you food.
Just, I mean, remarkable to think about passing off something that is specific, because I'm sitting here thinking about any number of products, you know, any number of food things that you think, you know, I guess I'm from Western Pennsylvania, so the thing that always comes to my mind is ketchup, Heinz ketchup.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then there's other people, you know, they, even at the local amusement park, they tried serving Hunt's, and I'm pretty sure they almost burnt the place to the ground. Maybe not that extreme, but it was pretty bad there for a little while. And why? I mean, I understand the profit margin that can be made from it, but isn't there some ethical clause somewhere in here if you're selling Kobe beef that you should actually be selling it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's ethical issues and there's legal issues. But, you know, I just want to backpedal a second here because you mentioned Heinz. It's a very interesting connection. So not many people know this, but the reason that we even have the FDA today has a lot to do with Heinz back in the day. And I forget, I think it was, I don't know if it was Teddy Roosevelt. I forget who the president was at the time, but Heinz, you know, lobbied to have the government enforce sort of the security of foods because they were making this ketchup and then people were knocking it off with inferior products. And they wanted somebody to, you know, sort of protect the consumer from labels. And, you know, so the whole genesis of the FDA is indirectly tied to your Pennsylvania Heinz friends. so it's kind of interesting.
Small world. No, but, I mean, I guess they were on point there. I mean, that's been an issue for as long as people have been putting their name on food then.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things, the perspectives I was able to get from traveling the world is in that most of the rest of the world, food is viewed geographically. So I don't know if you drink wine or not, but traditionally, the way wine was labeled was based on place, right?
Yeah.
You have wines like Burgundy and Chianti and Champagne, and these are all places. They're not really a style, right? When you buy red Burgundy, it's made from Pinot Noir, but that's because the people in Burgundy use Pinot Noir. So for wine lovers all around the world, these place names have very specific meanings. If you're into wine, you know what Burgundy is, you know what Chianti is, because they're made a certain way where they come from. And Parmesan Reggiano cheese is the same. It comes from Parma and Reggio. And Kobe beef is the same. It comes from Kobe. But we don't really have that tradition in the U.S., with a very few exceptions like Vidalia onions, which come from Vidalia, Georgia, or Kona coffee, which comes from Kona in Hawaii. But we have a trademark system that's just based on company ownership. So we have never been willing to protect most of these names. And as such, it's completely legal for a winemaker in the U.S. to make Burgundy, to make Chianti, and to make it out of anything they want and any way they want, whereas where they're actually made, they have quality standards and rules about how they're made. So you have this sort of two-tiered system where if you go into a wine store in the U.S. and you buy a bottle of Burgundy from France, you can say without knowing anything about it that, you know, it has this kind of grape and it's made from a certain quality vineyard, and you know, have an expectation of quality. It's like a good housekeeping seal of approval just by the name. Or you could buy a bottle of Burgundy from the United States and literally have no idea what's in it or where it came from.
That's just troubling. I mean, I guess I've somewhere in my mind I've already knew that. But as you bring it to light, it just makes me unsettled. And as we get through some of these products, and you mentioned counterfeit vodka. Might as well mention that since we're in the alcoholic part of the show. I guess it just follows the same path as wine? Knocking it off?
With hard liquor, it's not as much of a problem. It's usually there like a case of brand names being knocked off. Interestingly, some of the American manufacturers use products, especially in the flavored liquors, that are illegal in other parts of the world. So when we export certain brands, it's actually a different formula that people in other countries buy, because we can sell it here, but we can't sell it there. But, you know, the shortage, I talked to the former chair of the FDA, and he told me basically, you know, it's all predictable based on economics. If you have a product that the consumer can't tell by sight, and you can sell them something cheaper, someone will. So, you know, vodka isn't a big problem, but it's very easy, right, because it's a clear liquid. And the same has gone for honey, right? There's honey is one of the most defrauded products in the world. People don't think about honey very much, but it's relatively expensive, and it's everywhere, and people put it in their tea in every supermarket, and most people have a jar of honey in their house. And it's basically amber-colored liquid that's sugar. So any combination of any kind of sugar product, like high fructose corn syrup and water and food coloring, can be made to look like a jar of honey. And so in these cases where, as a consumer, you look at something on the shelf and you can't tell what it is, like when you buy a chicken wing, you know what a chicken wing looks like. It might not be organic. It might claim to be organic, but at least you know you're getting a chicken wing. But with some of these products, you don't know, because all you can tell is it's clear, it's amber. I mean, milk has a really long history of fraud going back hundreds of years, because you could always mix things like flour into it and thicken it and extend it and make a bigger margin, and people couldn't tell by looking at it.
Or what is 2% anyways? I mean, anyways. Another thing that you can't see by looking at it.
Exactly. And it's, I mean, I talk a lot about seafood. Seafood is definitely like one of the most problematic, if not the most problematic, categories in this country. And it's the same reason. In a lot of the world, it's completely normal to buy and prepare a whole fish, right? In yeah. Asia, in the Caribbean, in Latin America, but not so much in the U.S. We go to the supermarket and we buy fillets, and most of the fish we eat are white fish, and all white fish fillets look the same. So if you go to the supermarket and you say, I want to buy a whole red snapper, right? Red snapper is one of the most expensive fish per pound sold in the United States, considered very desirable. You buy a whole red snapper, they can't really fool you if you know, have any idea what a red snapper looks like. But if you order a red snapper fillet, they can sell you almost any kind of whitefish fillet, tilapia, catfish, doesn't matter, all looks the same. And that happens a shocking amount of the time, more than three quarters of the time. So, you know, the consumer, one of the reasons I stress the idea of buying the whole food in a literal sense is, at least if you see it, it's much harder to be ripped off. You know, a very simple example is juice. There's a long history of juice fraud. You buy an apple, you know what you're getting. You buy apple juice, you don't.
So is there any food out there that's safe, like that we can always just look at and say, yeah, that's what we're getting?
Yeah, there is. And maybe we kind of got off on the wrong foot, because, you know, despite where we're headed, I'm actually very optimistic about this. And I love food. You know, I'm a restaurant critic. I eat out all the time. I cook all the time. I love food. And when I was writing this book, right, it's called Real Food, Fake Food, but I got so frustrated for so much of the time, because I saw all these scams and all this sort of evil in the commercial world of food, that my working title was Fake Food, Real Food, right? Just flipped over. Not a big deal, but that's what I was thinking of. I'm like, there's this fake food out there, fake food. And then, you know, one day I came to the realization that the only reason that there is fake food is because there's real food. And I use the analogy in the book, say, you know, like, there's guys on the street selling fake Rolexes and fake Gucci bags, right? Things like this. And the reason that they knock these off is because they're desirable, you know, high-quality items. They're not, I don't want to belittle, you know, Timex, but you don't see a lot of fake Timexes being sold on the street. You see fake Rolexes. And it's the same with food. They're knocking off foods you want to eat. And I kind of had this aha moment, and so I flipped the title, because the real food is the most important. And half the book is about real food and what makes it taste so good. And I kind of take the reader to these places like Kobe and Parma and Champagne, show them how the real product is made, try to explain what makes it so good, and then talk about the fraud and give tips on how to avoid it. So I'm trying to approach it from like that, the glass half full perspective. It's not you should be scared to eat. You know, I do, you know, I hear people that said, I read your book and I'm afraid to go shopping or I'm afraid to eat sushi, whatever. But I also get people who said, you know, I read your book and I started like buying better olive oil, or I bought real Parmesan Reggiano cheese and it changed my life. And that's really the goal, is, you know, that this food is good and it's out there and it's readily available. And the biggest thing, the biggest impediment is just knowledge. At the end of every chapter, and I have like a chapter on cheese, a chapter on seafood, I give a list of very specific tips, labels, things to ask, things to look for in the store. And once you get armed with knowledge and start shopping better and ordering better and buying better, you're eating better and you're eating healthier, and that's all a good thing.
Yeah, I was sitting here pondering. I don't know if you've got into this at all, but you know, there's this obesity crisis, and I'm thinking, well, if you're stuffing our milk with flour and all this other stuff, no wonder we're all gaining weight, because I'm sure the fatty, the acidic, the high fructose corn syrup, these things aren't great for any of us. So, plus all the potato chips and all the other things in the world that we all get our hands on because they're readily available. But anyways.
Yeah, and I mean, there's definitely health ramifications of this. And, you know, one of the things is, like, I personally, I love steak, right? I like red meat. And all my life, you know, the sort of perspective of the medical establishment has been, you know, you shouldn't eat too much red meat. It's bad for your heart. Yet, if you look at, and the United States has, I believe, the third highest per capita consumption of beef in the world. We eat a lot of beef. But the countries that are ahead of us, which are Argentina and Uruguay, they eat a lot more beef. In Uruguay, they eat twice as much beef per person as they do here in the U.S., and they have among the lowest heart disease rates in the world, whereas we have among the highest. So I look at something like that, and I say, you know, the problem isn't that we're eating red meat, the problem is that we're eating our red meat. And if you look at the way that cattle is raised in Uruguay and Argentina, it's not full of antibiotics and growth steroids and hormones, and it doesn't eat a weird, unnatural diet of animal byproducts. They're raised the way like we used to raise cattle here, cowboys. They go out and they eat grass. And, you know, there's been numerous studies showing why, you know, natural drug-free grass-fed beef is better for you, but it's kind of obvious, yet we haven't really adopted that here in the U.S., and people don't realize this, but 80% of the antibiotics manufactured in the United States go directly into animal feed. So you think about, like, all of the hospitals in this country, all the urgent care centers, all the pharmacies. I don't know where, you know, you live, but if you're in New York, there's a freaking CVS on every block, right? So all of those pharmacies, all those hospitals, all those urgent care centers, every veterinary clinic, all of that medical care system in the United States together accounts for 1/5 of our antibiotics. The rest of it goes into animal feed. And that is why, in my opinion, we are having this rise of this drug-resistant antibiotic strains that are breaking out in hospitals that can't be treated, because we're eating so much antibiotics in our meat every day that we're becoming immune to antibiotics, basically, so they don't work when you need them.
80%. No one. Yeah, you're right. There's no wonder we're not, you know, because we're just taking it in constantly. Ugh. 80%.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to one doctor who said, you know, I get patients all the time who say, oh, I've never taken antibiotics, and he laughed, and he's like, you take antibiotics every day, you just don't know it.
Yeah, that's for sure. You mentioned olive oil. Now, I want to get into this a little bit with you just for a personal reason, because I buy the cheapest, low-grade, whatever, off the shelf. Am I doing the right thing there?
No.
No? Oh, no.
No. And, you know, the thing with olive oil is that we, and this is something I feel very strongly about, because I love olive oil.
Obviously. That's why I'm bringing it up, because...
But, you know, the cost difference... So the average American consumes less than a liter of olive oil a year. And then there's people like me who maybe consume six times that, right? And but if you lived in Greece, you would consume 24 liters of olive oil a year. So we're like, you know, we're pretty low consumers. And again, I equate it to wine, right? If you were drinking one or two or three or six bottles of wine a year, and there was a quality difference, would you care so much if you paid $8 or you paid $12? If you're, you know, you're not having it every day, right?
Right.
You're doing this a couple of times a year. And olive oil is very much the same way. Yeah, you can save money on a bottle, but you don't really buy that many bottles to justify that. It's one of those products you can afford to splurge on because you don't use a whole lot of it. And the splurge isn't a big splurge. You know, we're talking about a couple of bucks a bottle difference. So, yeah, I can't get behind buying the cheapest stuff, you know, for a variety of reasons. There's a lot of great things about olive oil, and there's a lot of problems with it. But the good stuff tastes so much better that once you have it, it's hard to go back.
Okay, so help me find the good stuff then, because as you're looking at the shelf, they all, you know, glass bottles, plastic, you know, whatever.
And there's a lot of subliminal marketing fraud that, you know, a lot of them have pictures of, like, you know, olive groves and chateaus in Tuscany. But, you know, because, you know, say food producers and food marketers are not stupid, right? They understand the American public, and they've done a lot of research. And in polls, Americans say the most important consideration to them when buying olive oil is that it come from Italy. Italy has been marketed ever since The Godfather, and, you know, we have this, a lot of Italian immigrants, and there's great olive oil in Italy, but we have this association of olive oil in Italy, which isn't really accurate. Spain is the largest olive oil producer in the world. Greece is probably the most famous country in terms of cuisine with olive oil. Olive oil goes back to the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians, and it grows, olives grow everywhere in the Mediterranean basin, Morocco, Tunisia, Portugal. Italy is actually the world's largest olive oil importer. So what the companies do is they buy up olive oil from all over, bring it to Italy, put it in bottles, put bottled in Italy on it, and ship it out to the U.S. And we see it, and there's a picture of that, you know, Tuscany on it, and it says bottled in Italy, and we assume that it's Italian. It's not. There's nothing wrong with Italian olive oil, but Italy consumes a lot of olive oil, and they keep the good stuff at home for the most part. So I've consumed a lot of Italian olive oil, but I usually have bought it in Italy and carried it home. Here, I typically you know, look for other things. But the biggest thing is with olive oil is that it be fresh, and people don't always realize this, but all of the other food oils that we consume regularly, which are, you know, canola oil, which comes from rapeseed, corn oil, which comes from corn, soy oil comes from soybeans, peanut oil, peanuts. These are all what are called seed oils because they all come from seeds of vegetables. And to extract that, you have to go through a fairly complex process. You can't take an ear of corn at home and turn it into oil. But olives are fruit. And olive oil is nothing but fresh squeezed juice. Olive oil is literally obtained by crushing an olive. You could do that at home. It would be a pain, but you could do it. It's like the oil equivalent of fresh squeezed orange juice. Olives just happen to contain oil instead of juice. So because it's a fruit juice, it's very fresh. And you might take a bottle of canola oil and use some of it and put it back under your sink and use it again 3 months later. But you would never do that with a bottle of orange juice. Yet people do that with olive oil, and it tastes bad, and they wonder why. Well, because it goes stale very fast. It's fresh juice. Same thing on the shelf. A good bottle of olive oil from the minute it's pressed and put in the bottle unopened has a shelf life of about a year. But, you know, it takes 2 to 3 months just to get here because it has to be bottled and sent to a warehouse and put on a boat and sent to a distributor, right? So you're already sort of a quarter of the way into the useful life of the olive oil when it first arrives in this country. Also, olives are only harvested in the fall and once a year. So in all of the Mediterranean basin, all these countries, the olive oil is basically made around November. It gets here in January. If you buy a bottle in October, it's already kind of near the end of its useful life. even though it's a brand new bottle. And that's assuming that that bottle came that year. It might have been at the supermarket warehouse already for 2 years or 3 years. I've seen bottles of olive oil more than 3 years old on the shelf. And to make that worse is very few of them have any dates. So this is like the number one tip that I give to answer your question, is when you go to the supermarket or the gourmet store, wherever you buy your olive oil, look at the bottles and look for ones that have a pressed on or harvested on date. And it's not required to be put on there by law, but the good producers do it. And that will tell you when that olive oil was born. And you want that to be as recently as possible, but ideally, you know, no more than a year ago. And because people have become savvy to that, what some producers have started doing is putting on a bottled-on date. And bottled-on is not the same as harvested or pressed-on, because that oil could have sat in a stainless steel tank for 2 years before they put it in the bottle. Some places put a use-on date, which is also useless because they don't want their olive oil to get thrown away. So don't put that use-by date 2 or 3 years out, even though that's too long. So the number one thing you can do as a consumer is look for olive oil with a harvested or pressed-on date, because olive oil is always made within 24 hours of being harvested, so it's essentially the same thing. And you want to buy it fresh. And if they don't have that date, then look for one that does, and give those people who are willing to, you know, go the extra mile your money.
So when I'm pressing these olives at home, how big of a mess should I expect to make, and how much will my wife hate you for mentioning this?
No, you'd actually need, I mean, you'd need something to crush it. You know, it's hard to do by hand. That's why they have these big wheels. But interestingly, today most olive oil is made with a centrifuge, so they spin it really fast and the oil comes out of it, which is actually better than crushing it between stones, which is what they used to do. But in either case, the legal definition of extra virgin olive oil is basically olive juice that's extracted mechanically. It can't be heated, it can't have chemicals, it's just juice from olives, and that's why it's so good. And you know, you can get good olive oil from all over the world. There's great olive oil from California. And the other thing people don't realize is now a lot of countries in the southern hemisphere have really upped their olive oil game. You know, typically grows in the same places where wine grows well, which is why, you know, you think of olive oil coming from Spain and the south of France and Italy and California. It also comes from Chile and Argentina and Australia and South Africa. And because the seasons are reversed, like I said, if you go to the supermarket in November and you go to buy Italian olive oil, well, it's going to be a year old. But if you buy Argentinian olive oil, it's going to be almost brand new, because their fall is in our spring. So, you know, if you know what to look for, and this is kind of like little tips that I give, you can always find something good.
Just blowing my mind here as we're thinking about this. And then I'm sitting here thinking, I can't believe I'm talking about this on air with people actually listening to it and interested in it. But they are. This is great. So extra virgin olive oil is machine separated. So how say that again?
It means it's the juice of the olive obtained through mechanical means. And by mechanical means, they mean that it can't involve heat or solvents or chemicals, which are how other things are extracted. It's either crushed, like between two stones, which is how they traditionally did it, and some places still do it, or spun in a centrifuge at really high speed until the oil comes out, or like wine grapes at a lot of places today, they crush it with like an inflatable bladder. So they put it, you know, in like a sieve and then blow up a giant balloon against it, and it crushes the juice. But so it's always some form of sort of essentially crushing the olive. That juice comes out, and that's called virgin olive oil, right? You're not allowed to do anything to it. You're not allowed to add anything. You're not allowed to heat it. You're not allowed to process it. That's virgin olive oil. Once you get that, it has to be graded. And it's graded in two ways. It's graded in the laboratory, and there's polyphenol counts and acidity, and they have standards for each one of these factors and cutoffs. So it's, you know, like taking a test at school. They grade that olive oil, and if it scores above a certain level on those laboratory tests, then it's extra virgin. If it scores below that, it's just virgin. And if it scores below that, it's called lampante, which is Italian for lamp oil, and that's not meant in a really good way. And if it scores in the Lampante category, according to the USDA, it's considered unfit for human consumption. So they can't sell that. But then it also has to go through a second test, which is sensory evaluation, which is literally a panel of expert tasters. And there's very, very few foods in the world that are regulated by taste. You know, when you go buy like a steak, there's nobody at the USDA tasting it and saying, yeah, I give this the thumbs up. Very few foods. Interestingly, Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese, which we mentioned earlier, is one of the other ones that has an actual taste test to get its seal of approval. But so this panel of tasters will try the oil, and there's 16 factors that they call defects, right? And they're like rancidity, earthiness, you know, different. And if they find any one of these 16 factors, it fails. So extra virgin olive oil is like the most perfect olive oil there can be. And it's only, depending on the year and the harvest, somewhere around 10% of all the olive oil made. So it's like, I sometimes, you know, say it's like gasoline. You know, you go up there and there's like ultra premium, super premium, and regular. So, you know, we only know really about extra virgin olive oil because that's what everybody says. But that's the highest grade of olive oil you can buy. And that's what you should be buying. And so then there's a virgin, which is hard to find in this country. In Europe, people buy it more because it's cheaper and they use it for cooking. But that hasn't really caught on in the U.S. And then that third category, the Lampante, what they do, because it's unfit for human consumption, is then they refine it. They basically distill it, heat it, purify it. It becomes a neutral oil. It no longer has any taste. And now it's edible, and they use it in other things like salad dressing. So the one that you want to buy is always extra virgin. And you can find, you'll see bottles at the supermarket sometimes that say light olive oil. And again, you know, light is something that's designed to cater to Americans' fear of obesity. But in this case, light olive oil doesn't actually have any less calories. It's light in flavor. Sometimes it'll just say pure olive oil or Mediterranean olive oil. But if it doesn't say extra virgin on the label, you don't want to buy it.
Mind-blowing. Good stuff, but who knew that it was just so, the water was so muddy with that. So, I've got a question from my chat room. I'm not sure who threw it up there, but I'm not sure how much you know about this, but I'm going to ask you anyways, because, well, you're a food guy, so you might have a solid answer on this. Non-stick pans versus, like, the old cast iron. Is there any preference for you?
Yeah, I use both. The fear with nonstick pans is the coating coming off, basically, right? Because, you know, you don't want to be eating Teflon or whatever it's made out of. So my rule is, you know, to not buy, like, the cheapest nonstick pan and to keep an eye on it. And, you know, with nonstick pans, you're supposed to basically use non-metal implements, right? Like a rubber or wood spatula, things that won't scratch it. If it becomes scratched, I would toss it. You don't want the coating coming off. You don't want it in your food. But I do use nonstick pans. You know, like if you ever go to like a Sunday buffet at a restaurant and you see them, you know, like the guy at the omelet station making omelets, they're always using nonstick pans. They're really good for things like eggs that you need to flip that tend to stick. Fish can be good in it. So it just depends really what you're cooking. Cast iron pans have had a revival among chefs recently. I actually used one tonight. I, you know, cooked dinner in a cast iron pan before I came on the show with you today. So they're great because they retain a lot of heat. They're really good for steak, for searing, for burgers, for things like that. The problem is they're a little bit harder to clean, and they freak some people out because you're supposed to leave, you know, like a little buildup of oil on them in between cooking, and some people think that's not that sanitary. I don't worry about it because you're heating it up anyway. But with cast iron pans, it's best if you clean it immediately after you cook when it's hot, and that can be a pain because, A, you're trying to eat, and B, you're juggling this hot pan with like a mitt in the sink. but they work great.
For the listeners out there, I love cast iron. I scraped too many nonstick pans. Like I own one, but I don't use it. I let my wife use it.
She and I grill a lot, so I like to use the cast iron pans on the grill, you know, because they're basically indestructible. So
yeah, so far, I'm pushing my luck, though, I'm pretty sure. No, hopefully not. Maybe. Probably knowing my luck. If it's breakable, I'll find a way. Now, I've seen this, and I could see this as a problem for most of my listeners, and I just want to bring this up because this boggled my... Here we are boggling my mind again. But I understand the principle now that we've talked about a little bit, but we're going to still mention it just for the sake of saying it. Counterfeit coffee? Are we serious right now?
So, this is not a big problem today for most people, but what most people don't realize is just, I mean, coffee is the single most valuable agricultural product in the world and the second most valuable commodity after oil, right? The annual value of the coffee market is more than gold, it's more than coal, it's more than meat. I mean, only oil, right? It's a huge market. And just about, you know, even though we think sometimes, you know, of certain countries like in Asia consuming tea, and they do, coffee is a worldwide phenomenon. It is widely enjoyed pretty much everywhere in the world, and in a lot of countries, it's like the only choice. And so it's a very big market, big dollars, and it's a very diverse chain. It comes from all over the place. It's produced, I forget the number, but, you know, over like 100 different countries grow coffee. There's all kinds of varieties. And it's got a lot of small farmers in less developed countries. So it's a convoluted supply chain. And anytime, you know, there's a lot of moving parts, it lends itself to adulteration. The good news, and it historically, coffee has been very subject to adulteration, because for most of history, people bought only ground coffee because they didn't have coffee grinders at home. You couldn't go get like a Black & Decker or Krupp's home coffee grinder. And ground coffee, you could put things in. You could throw twigs, or you could throw leaves, or you could throw burnt paper, sawdust. We talked about sawdust earlier. That would go into ground coffee. Today, most people, or not, I don't know if most people, but everyone has the option to buy whole beans. And even if you don't have a grinder, you can buy whole beans at most supermarkets and grind them yourself there, right? Because they have a grinder for you. So once you take that step, you really can't be defrauded in the sense of adulteration. Coffee beans are very distinctive. You know what they look like. If they threw a bunch of, like, garbanzo beans in there, you would notice it, right? coffee beans are coffee beans. It comes back to the whole food. This is exactly what I was talking about. Like, you know what a coffee bean looks like. So once you buy it, you know you're getting coffee, and you grind it yourself. The one problem with coffee is, even though you know what a coffee bean looks like, you can't tell, like, a Jamaican Blue Mountain bean from a Kenyan AA bean, you know? So there's all these kinds of beans, and they cost wildly different amounts. If you go to, like, a fancy coffee store and they have these barrels, some will be $8 a pound and some will be $25 a pound, and you can't really tell. So you might get ripped off in terms of paying for a kind of fancy coffee bean you're really not getting. But the good news with coffee is, if you buy beans, you're getting coffee, and if you like the way it tastes, then you're happy. So it's actually one of the kind of simpler foods to buy, but it has one of the oldest and longest and richest histories of adulteration of any food product.
One of the easier food products to buy, but one of the more difficult food products to buy, too, because there's so many different varieties.
Yeah, and it really comes down, like, you have to try, you know, like, and your tastes change over time. I drink a lot of coffee, and I used to like a really dark roast, so I would buy a French roast or an espresso kind of roast, and as I've gotten older, I've gotten to, like, a more mild coffee, but that's, you know, the good thing about it is, especially when you buy by the beans, you don't have to buy any particular quantity. You can buy a half pound, you can buy a quarter pound, you can buy 3/4 of a pound, you can try it, you don't like it, get something else the next time.
Buy it by the ton. Oh, wait, never mind.
But I do tell people, just don't buy it pre-ground. You know, there's just no reason to today.
Well, what's the, I mean, we talked about with olive oil earlier. What's the life, do you know the lifespan of a coffee bean? Does it disintegrate the same way olive oil does, or?
It's certainly more stable than olive oil, especially because it's, you know, already been roasted. So, you know, fresh coffee beans are green. If you ever see it roasted, it's kind of cool. But once it's roasted, you know, it's sort of like, you know, nuts. They have a longer shelf life. I don't actually know how long it is, but I keep my own beans in the freezer. which I have read prolongs the life, though they don't do that at the supermarket. So, you know, I don't know how old they are when I already buy them. But I guess, you know, again, I go back to the olive oil example. Like, I've had really good olive oil. I've had the best olive oil in the world. I've had it fresh. I've been to Harvest. And I can tell when bad olive oil, what it tastes like. So I've had a lot of coffee, too. And I know that my coffee isn't that bad, so I assume I'm doing something wrong, right?
Something. You're doing something. We're not sure yet what. Question from the chat room. What do you think about this lab-grown meat, real meat? It's coming to the market in the United States later this year. Ugh. Anyways, go ahead.
Yeah. So I'm a little skeptical just because I don't know, like, you know, the science behind it. But, you know, it's... It doesn't actually bother me as much as the fake meat, like these, like, you know, Beyond Meat, whatever it's called, you know, like Burger King just rolled out. And it's not that I have anything against vegetarian burgers. What I don't like is a lot of these products are being marketed in a deceptive way. They're not being marketed as, like, an alternative. They're being marketed as the real product, and they're not. And, like, I got a PR pitch the other day for a product called Just Eggs. Right, and if it was just orange juice, you'd have no doubt. But hey, just orange juice, what is it? Right, it's orange juice, but just eggs has no eggs. It's like synthetic plant-based eggs. So if people want plant-based eggs, I'm totally fine with that. But call it like fake eggs or
just eggs makes me think that, you know, that just the chicken was just here.
Yeah, and I saw like a brand in vegetable chicken products in the supermarket that was called Chicken, but with an apostrophe instead of the E, right? So it's like chicken. And, you know, and so I just think, you know, if you're going to make imitations of things, you know, I actually say in my book, I love the word imitation, right? Because if you tell me, hey, I'm serving imitation Kobe beef or imitation champagne, well, I know right away that that's not the real thing. I'm no longer getting confused. I'm no longer getting ripped off. I might want to say, well, how do you make it or what, you know, but it's a great clarifier. And, but the lab grown meat is a little different because it's really meat. It's interesting to see because there are, I mean, the big issue with food sustainability is that there's a lot of people in the world. You know, when I was growing up, I remember when the population of the world was like 3 point something billion and now it's 8 point something billion, right? That's a big change. And it's not getting any smaller. So, you know, ultimately, you can only raise, you know, so many animals and grow so many vegetables. So I guess this is where the future is taking us. It's going to be interesting to see.
And what is wrong with a nice cooked portobello mushroom?
Yeah, if you'd like it, nothing.
Well, I'm just saying to all these people out there who are trying to reinvent this vegetarian burger thing, just irritates me. Chopping up a whole bunch of stuff and trying to make it look like a good patty. It just slap a portobello on there and move on with your life if that's what you want.
Anyways. Yeah, it's not like there's not lots of great vegetarian dishes, like pizza.
I guess that comes back to your point of buying the whole food and just, you know what you got there.
Yeah, exactly.
So I wanted to get into this, a couple of little things. I look at the clock and I'm like, well, if I don't do it now, we probably won't get into them. You, in 2002 or 2001, that you were one of the top 10 extreme journalists. Do I even want to get here? What makes you extreme? Or is this some kind of gag that I'm not paying attention to, or what?
No. So I mentioned, Real Food, Fake Food, while it was like a big seller, was not my first book. And my previous book before this was called Getting into Guinness. And it was about the history and cultural impact of the Guinness Book of World Records, which I think is really fascinating. I wrote it, so I'm not a little bit biased. I think it's a great book, but it didn't sell particularly well. Not a lot of people read it. You know, it's all, you know, the Guinness Book of World Records. Most people don't know this, but it's the best-selling copyrighted book in human history. And by most informed estimates, it's the fourth most widely read book of all time after the Bible and Chairman Mao's Little Red Book and the Quran. So it's pretty big in terms of, you know, it's translated into more than 100 languages. It's been a bestseller in pretty much every country it's released in every year for the last 50 years. It's spawned TV shows. So it's kind of like a big cultural deal. And I actually make the argument that the Guinness Book of World Records is the prequel or the forerunner to reality TV. And but anyway, in the course of writing this book, to sort of immerse myself in the world, I set three Guinness World Records myself, and that's sort of why they dubbed me these extreme journalists, because I did these wacky things.
Do you still hold any of these records, or have they all been broken?
You know, so that people ask me that all the time. It's a weird question, because the Guinness Book of World Records, because their whole sort of franchise is selling this book every year, they don't make the database available electronically, and the book is a best of compilation. You know, it only has like a small percentage of all the records they maintain. So there's really no way to know when somebody breaks your record unless you happen to like see it in the newspaper. And only so when you they have a very complex process, but if you want to break a record or set a new record, you apply by writing, or you can do it online. And then, you know, say you say, you know, hey, I want to break the record for, you know, most apples juggled. Then they'll tell you, okay, well, the current record is 17. But you'd have no way of knowing that until you go through the process. So I know that one of my three records was definitely broken because I saw it on the news. The other two... Actually, I know two of them were broken. The third one, I don't know if it still stands or not.
Well, give me one of the ones that was broken. Maybe I'll break it and bring it back closer to home.
So the very first one that I did was the longest marathon casino poker playing session. And I played poker at Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut for roughly 73 hours without
well, that's not going to happen. So what's the other one?
And that was broken. And not only was it broken, it was shattered. They took it to over 100, I believe, which is like another full day, which is a really long time.
I was going to say, I'm not sure I'm getting past like 36, so I'm not good there.
Your eyes start to really hurt. It's like watching TV, you know, it really tires out your eyes. Let's see. So the second one was – oh, actually, I'm sorry. That was the second one. The poker was the second one. The first one was the greatest distance traveled between two rounds of golf played in the same day, which is a little physically easier but logistically difficult. And that was 7,496 miles. So I played golf in Australia and then immediately jumped on a plane and flew back to the U.S. and played here all in the same day.
You know, I've actually heard of that one before. That's ridiculous, by the way. Congratulations on doing it. Just having the ability to do that, first and foremost.
Well,
alone.
You know, I looked through the golf section, and it's like the book is ruled by Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods, so I'm like, well, I really can't beat those guys.
Me either. There might have been a time where I might have had a brief, but that was very brief, like that Caddyshack round, but that's about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. And I keep playing. So that one got broken too. And then the third one, the one that may or may not still stand, was the most different ski trails skied in their entirety in 8 hours. And that is 64. And that one I've never heard of being broken, but I actually did it. I wrote an article about it for Outside Magazine, and I sort of used it to lay out the whole Guinness process and how to break it and challenge the readers to break it. So I expected it to be broken, but I never actually heard that it was.
What defines a trail? Does it have to be a certain length?
As it appears on the map of the ski resort. So they have, like, really detailed rules. It's one of the things that surprised, you know, because people are like, oh, he, you know, did jumping jacks for... you know, whatever hours, but they, when you apply, they tell you like how many witnesses you need, what kind of documentation, whether you need like video, the endurance ones, like the poker, you need to have a medical observation. So they set out like really strict rules for each record because they want, even if though their records are sometimes really bizarre and really funny, they take them seriously, but they also want them to be standardized so that when the next person goes to break it, they have like a framework to do it in.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. That's, but still, Because I'm sitting here thinking I can just put up like 64 different little trails. Well, of course I can't ski, so that's not the point.
But. Yeah, it's harder than you think because they say like in their entirety. So, you know, like a lot of times at ski resorts, the trails interconnect. And so you'd have to do like, even if it's like three trails woven together, you'd have to do three different rides up the lift. And then a lot of ski resorts don't even have, I mean,
I was gonna say,
a big ski resort has 100 runs, right? So, and they have to all be open. They have to have snow. You know, you went to, you know, Jack Frost in Pennsylvania. They probably don't even have 64 runs, right? So you couldn't do it.
That's what I'm just sitting here thinking, how many ski resorts have that many runs? And then, as you're mentioning, there's the time down and there's time up. I mean, there's a literal limitation to it. I mean, unless you're really
Even if you're like Lindsey Vonn or Bodie Miller and you can ski really fast, the limitation is riding the lift, right? That takes everyone the same amount of time. So I did it actually at Crested Butte Ski Resort in Colorado, but there's probably, you know, there's maybe, I would say, a dozen. There's more than a dozen resorts in the U.S. that have more than 64 runs, but that would be, like, viable for record breaking.
Good to know. I guess.
Yeah, useful information, right?
Yeah, back to the... Okay, so the other one, it was just an article that you had published the other day, and I did look it up just for the last because I had to see it, but this TSA Swiss Army knife, which is kind of misleading because it's just kind of a dud, in my opinion, but go ahead, give me a little bit more. I mean, what? It's a line opener.
Yeah, so it is actually, I do agree with you, it's a little bit of a dud, but what happened was when, you know, they sort of first rolled out the new TSA rules, they made like a much fuller version that I bought and I own and I've been carrying for, I don't know, like the last 3 years, and I love it because it's like a full featured Swiss Army knife. It has like 18 different tools. It just doesn't have the actual blade, so which is what makes it TSA legal, but it has the scissors, you know, so, you know, I'm traveling and I don't know, I need to cut a Band-Aid or cut a tag out of clothing or, you know, run into stuff in your hotel. And then when I went to do the story, I saw that they actually discontinued that model and replaced it with this smaller one that just has like a scissor and, you know, it looks like basically like the small Swiss Army knife that a lot of people have on their keychain, but without the blade. But it's still, you know, it's kind of handy to have that scissor and the screwdriver with you. I think maybe also pops beers, you know, when you travel. So, you know, it's not the best tool you could carry with you, but it's the only tool you could carry on the plane.
Still disappointing. Just saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I had the small one as a kid, and I had the bigger, you know, the big, I don't know how many tools I had, but it just felt huge. Like, it was just impressive, you know, it was just, you know, and then how many cuts on my hands are from it, I can't remember, but more than a fair share. Realfoodsfakefoods.com, what else do we need to talk about real quick here before we run out of time?
You know, if people want to see the TEDx talk, which is a little bit, you know, more concise and, you know, more, I would say, instructional, maybe, than what we talked about, just straight up tips. They should check that out. They'll just have to Google it, but, you know, because the address is too long for me to say. But yeah, you know, my book, the biggest thing is I think the tips. At the end of every chapter, you know, people want, like, action points and something that they can do. You know, they hear this on the radio and they say, yeah, I want to buy better olive oil, but maybe don't remember everything we said. So it's all in there, and, you know, it's out in paperback now, so it's cheaper. They can get it on Kindle. You know, they can get it on audio, however people want it. Real food, fake food.
And they have to buy the whole book, right, just to make sure we're clear.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's selling it by chapters, you know, but you don't know, because it's interesting in the publishing industry, you know, they license, you know, the audio book is done by a different company, you know, you just sort of sign your life away, so I don't even know what's going on.
There's a business idea out there for somebody, selling books by chapter. Anybody out there who really needs a bad idea? Well, Larry, I want to thank you for the time. I enjoyed it immensely. Of course, now I'm going to go look at my olive oil, and then I'm going to have to go shopping probably tomorrow. So, just for the record, you're on the hook for that.
Yeah, but you'll like it. It'll be worth it. You'll be thanking me.
I will. All right, have a good evening.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
And that's Larry Olmsted there, talking olive oil, talking all sorts of good stuff. I wanted to clean up the show real quick. I got 30 seconds left. If you have not been to Mauer.com, you have not been to Mauer.com. Of course you have been to Mauer.com. New look-ish today. I finally got the new server done, the new Icecast server's done. The links down the side are all correct and all current as of today. So all those places have the show. If you haven't signed up for the newsletter's coming back. I had to disconnect it while I was changing servers because, anyways, as you can imagine, it didn't work right. So it'll be back shortly as I reconnect everything. But that's the last thing on the list to do, so we're going to do that probably tomorrow. Have a good night, everybody.
The views and opinions expressed on the Mallard Report are those of the host and participants. For past shows, social media links, and so much more, visit Mallard.com, MALLIARD.com. And thanks for listening.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, 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 cut.
Oh, come on. It wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on CannedAirPodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.